From Michigan Radio, this is Stateside. I'm Cynthia Canty. Today, a congressional report blisters the National Highway Traffic Safety Administration over missing ignition defects in GM vehicles.
They had ample information to have discovered this problem in 2007, but just for a number of different failures, didn't do it.
We look at tax increment financing, public dollars used with few questions asked.
This has worked or this has not worked. This has been a good use of public money or it hasn't.
We meet the MSU professor leading the quest for a better potato.
If you saw me driving around campus and my license plate says Spud, so I kind of wear it on my sleeve.
And Detroit's techno music scene winning fans around the world.
Their image of Detroit is an artistic utopia.
Those stories and much more today on Stateside. We all like to know where our tax dollars are going, what they're being used for. But tax increment financing, or TIFs, is making that hard. I'm Cynthia Canty. Today on Stateside, just what is a TIF and why are TIFs making headlines at the state capitol? But first, a blistering congressional report came out today on the National Highway Traffic Safety Administration. The House Energy and Commerce Committee report analyzed NHTSA's handling of General Motors' ignition switch problem, a problem that's led to 19 deaths. Detroit News D.C. Bureau Chief David Shepherdson is here. David, could one make a good case that this report really hauls NHTSA into the congressional woodshed?
Oh, absolutely. It even compares the GM salute, which, if you remember from GM's report, which found that employees routinely, pushed off responsibility for problems, that at NHTSA, there was the NHTSA shrug, where they didn't follow up enough. And I think one of the key problems that this report shows is that back in 2007, when a senior agency official said, hey, we have reports of four fatal crashes in cobalts and ions, we need to open a formal investigation. But ultimately, the agency declined to do that in November of that year. And what the report says is that in the succeeding years, as more evidence and more cases were reported of cobalts and ions in crashes where the airbags failed to deploy, they pointed to that decision and said, well, we've already decided not to investigate this formally. And as a result, they never went back and they never, not just connected the dots, they never put together all of the various pieces of evidence that various parts of NHTSA had. And that's what the committee report says, is that they had ample information to have discovered this problem in 2007, but just for a number of different failures, didn't do it.
And as you point out in your piece for the Detroit News, that agency investigators virtually never even discussed the problems before GM launched that recall in February, and this is the agency supposed to be the safety watchdog for America's drivers.
And I think that really points out one of the differences between then and now, is that the agency now is pushing the auto company to say, hey, we need to be in constant communications. We need to understand all of these various systems and how they interact. But it's pretty staggering that between 2007 and 2014, when there were a number of reports, of fatal crashes and serious crashes where the airbags were not deploying, the only time that the agency and GM discussed this problem was in an offhand conversation in early 2007 at a GM workshop that the auto company was putting on for the agency about its airbags. And it is a difference today. Now the agency is far more aggressive about talking to the companies. But this report points out a whole host of problems. And one is simply that because they only have 51 people total, it's basically the same number they've had for 15 years, even though the number of vehicles has sold annually has gone up dramatically. The complexity of vehicle systems has grown by order of magnitude, that the agency question, or arguably, according to the committee, does not have the technical expertise and often gets bogged down in the issue of the day. And that raises the issue of today. They are so focused on GM. Mm-hmm. Can NHTSA spot the next problem, which could be bubbling up right now?
And training certainly seems to be lacking. I know the congressional investigators found these NHTSA investigators didn't even understand changes in the GM airbags. They were making assumptions on the old system.
And I think that point is absolutely fair. But I would say that GM didn't understand its own cars either. And so that point, I think it is a legitimate point that they did not understand how airbags worked. And in fact, as the report points out, that as a result of this, they learn more about how other companies' airbags work and have forced a recall at Chrysler of SUVs where those vehicles also had a similar system where if the ignition key moved out of position, that the airbag fails to deploy. And remember, this was not unintentional by the auto companies. I mean, when they were designing these airbags a decade or so ago, you had reports of many small women sitting in passenger seats and some children who should not have been sitting in the front seat dying because of the powerful force of these frontal airbags. So that led to the industry creating these advanced airbags that sense the size of the person in the seat. And because of the danger of airbags killing people, especially if they're sitting too close to the steering wheel because they were so powerful, they decided that, in fact, in many cases, if you're not wearing a seatbelt, it could be more dangerous to have the airbag deploy. So that was one of the, you know, it was one of the trade-offs these companies were making in terms of deciding how do we protect people with airbags, because, you know, they do save about 3,000 lives a year, but because they're so strong and powerful, they can also, you know, cause serious injuries or hurt people.
You know, it's ironic, isn't it, David, that the House report about NHTSA came out on the same day that acting NHTSA Administrator David Friedman ripped General Motors for making what he called incredibly poor decisions on recalls. And then NHTSA's got a date today with the Senate panel to discuss its failures. Ouch.
Well, yeah, and I don't think it's quite unintentional that the Energy and Commerce Committee put this report out the same day that the Senate is having this hearing on NHTSA reauthorization. I think, you know, the House committee has done far more legwork. I mean, they've gone through 2 million pages from GM and had done dozens of interviews with the people up and down the agency and at GM. And the Senate, you know, has done a more cursory investigation. They've had hearings, too. And I think this was an effort by the House to send a message, hey, we've really been working at this, and we want to be part of the conversation. Because this whole thing, you know, Congress is about to run out of town the next couple of days and head back to campaign, and, you know, they're not going to take up these auto safety bills until next year. But then when they come back, there is going to be a real debate about, does the agency need more staffing? Do they have the right technical expertise? Do they need more authority and higher fines, maximum fines, to deter auto companies from not delaying recalls? So the issue is not going to go away, but it's probably not going to be on the front burner until early next year.
David Shepardson is D.C. Bureau Chief for the Detroit News. As always, a pleasure. Thanks so much, David.
Hey, thanks. Enjoyed it.
The images of green water in Lake Erie and foul toxic tap water in Toledo certainly got a lot of us at least thinking about what is and isn't coming out of our taps. In other words, what is Michigan doing to protect our drinking water, the water we get from the Great Lakes system, protect it against cyanobacteria? Dan Wyant is director of the Michigan Department of Environmental Quality. It's good to talk to you.
Yeah, good to be with you.
Dan, seeing those green blooms of cyanobacteria on Lake Erie, popularly known as the algae blooms, what does that tell you about what needs to happen to preserve and protect our water quality?
Well, there needs to be a comprehensive plan to deal with blue-green algae. A lot of this is nutrients. Nutrients come from a lot of different factors, farms, large livestock, runoff. It comes from sediments that have been accumulated over time when rivers are dredged. It comes from solid waste and stormwater processing facilities. As large water events sometimes overflow, nutrients get into our waterway. So we need to address those. And on top of that, we've got this issue of aquatic invasive species that have added to this issue in Lake Erie. So all of that needs to be dealt with.
We know, Dan, that Ohio and some other states have set their own drinking water standards, but with people in Toledo not drinking their tap water, that doesn't seem to be working too well.
No, it does work. I mean, water is safe, and you can treat. And, you know, we do pull our waters from rivers. We pull our waters from lakes. We pull our drinking waters from groundwater. And so we treat it. And we can treat it to a safe level. So there are two sides of the story. You know, one side is, again, managing our drinking water, ensuring that it's safe, and there are standards, and there are processes in place to ensure that. And there was an issue in Toledo, and we did have a problem. It exceeded a health standard, and Toledo did the right thing, putting on a non-drink order. On the other side of this equation, we have water quality, and we all need to work towards improving water quality throughout not only the Great Lakes, but our rivers and streams. And so it is a priority for us in Michigan. We do contribute to the nutrient loading of Lake Erie. You know, we're only 15% of the land base. Ohio has the bigger piece, but Michigan wants to be a full partner. We think we have. We've led on a number of issues, removing phosphorus from lawn fertilizers, removing phosphorus from cleaning and detergents, and then putting all of our large livestock operations on a permit to ensure there's no discharge coming off those farms. So we think we have led on a number, but there's more to be done.
And with that in mind, I think it would surprise many of us to realize that there is not one federal benchmark. In fact, so many states actually look to the World Health Organization for a standard. And how big a problem is that in your eyes, Dan?
We need a national guideline. And so we've asked EPA to create a national guideline. We think all states should be consistent. So working with Ohio, we have met with EPA. EPA is committed to doing this, so they're moving forward to create this standard. It needs to be science-based. It needs to be protective. We need to engage the scientific peer community to give us that standard. So today we live with this World Health Organization number. It is the best number we have to date. It is protective. We feel good about that. But more science needs to be devoted to this to give the public greater assurance.
We're looking at clear water standards that are being drawn, as you say, sometimes from the World Health Organization. So the EPA says it's on it, but what do you think timeline-wise?
I think they're going to give us a guidance relatively soon. You know, we had the opportunity, my counterpart, the director of Ohio EPA, myself, the director of Michigan DEQ, Department of Environmental Quality, met with officials in Chicago a couple of weeks ago. We all committed to getting this done. We have help from our own congressional delegation, Candace Miller, in Michigan. And so we feel pretty confident we'll have guidance, we'll have a standard that's protective. And we're confident the standard we have today is that, but we want to give the public greater assurance that their drinking water is indeed safe.
This is Stateside. I'm Cynthia Canty. Next year will mark the 100th anniversary of one of the great atrocities of the 20th century, the genocide of up to 1.5 million Armenians by the Ottoman Empire. Scholars have acknowledged this to be one of the first modern genocides. The University of Michigan's Armenian Studies program is launching a series of events reflecting on the Armenian massacre and how the actions of 100 years ago are being felt in 2014. Catherine Babayan is a professor and director of the Armenian Studies program at U of M. What events led to what we call the Armenian massacre? What was happening in the Ottoman Empire, which, of course, today we know as Turkey?
Right. Well, that's a big question. You have to take a class for that. But in a nutshell, the Ottoman Empire was falling apart. It was referred to as the sick man of Europe. And the Armenians and the Greeks, the Assyrians as well, but these ethnic minorities were really the last minorities in Anatolia that were vying also for their own independence.
Now, Anatolia is?
Is modern-day Turkey.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
The Armenians, who were very much integrated also in the Ottoman, both politics and the intellectual life. But the image and vision for what would happen in this post-World War period was a space, well, that came to victimize certain peoples who were very central to the well-being of the Ottoman Empire as envisioned in a a more traditional imagination of the Ottomans.
So what exactly happened? What we call the massacre, mm-hmm. What happened?
April 24th is considered to be the beginning of the genocide because some 250 Armenian intellectuals as well as community leaders in Istanbul were rounded about and imprisoned. But actually we have massacres of Armenians prior to that. In fact, the immigration of Armenians to America probably began in the 1895-96 with the Hamidian, the Grand Vizier, the Ottoman Grand Vizier massacre of Armenians.
But this, the events of 1915 really took it to a new level. When we say 1.5 million mm-hmm. people dying in mm-hmm. this, how?
Well, there are at least two different phases of it. First of all, men were rounded up and either conscripted or killed. Women and children and elderly went on this death march of a movement outside of their homes towards Syria and the desert in Syria. So famine is one of the big features of this death march as well.
And yet, even today, Turkey denies that that word genocide is an accurate term for these mass killings. What's that argument about?
Well, it's a political argument. It is difficult for any kind of, ongoing, right, countries who are engaged in genocide to, first of all, in this case, Turkey, it's not their responsibility, but it's a responsibility of the past. And so it's a political move because it means a lot of different things. It also means reparations. It means possibly refugees who can come back, like in the case of Israel and Palestine as well. So there's a lot of political reverberations for this denial politics.
Why did so many Armenians make Michigan their home when the diaspora happened and people were fleeing? And what brought so many to Michigan?
Well, I think it's also the Michigan story, right? I think it's the Ford motor industry. Mm-hmm. And in 1914, Ford bringing out the $5 per day policy, which nearly doubled the wages.
When you look at the many problems facing our world in 2014, do you wonder if any lessons were learned with what happened to the Armenian people in 1915?
History repeats itself, but never in the same manner. And so in front of our eyes, there are genocides that are going on. Whether we've learned our lesson or not, the first genocide in the 20th century and then a series of genocides that follow the Holocaust, mm-hmm. that we continue not to do, to sit down very comfortably, maybe be armchair politicians or sit down on Facebook. But the fact that we're not out in rage of genocides that are going on currently, I would say, no, we didn't learn our lesson.
That was Catherine Babian, director of U of M's Armenian Studies program. The series of events commemorating the 100th anniversary of the Armenian Genocide begins tomorrow night. Actor, playwright, novelist Eric Bogosian will be on campus. He'll speak about his life as an Armenian American and an artist. You can get more information. Just Google Armenian Studies program at the University of Michigan. The power of music to build bridges. In this case, electronic and techno music, building bridges between Detroit and South Africa. That's the focus of a documentary film called Electric Roots, The Detroit Sound Project. The short was screened at the Cannes Film Festival this year. Filmmaker Christian Hill is based in Los Angeles, but he is from Detroit. Christian, you have been working on this documentary for years. Can you take us back to how it all began?
Well, we've actually been out on the road for 4 years. My partner and I, Jennifer Washington, we met at a party in Detroit 4 years ago, and we were just talking about like wanting to do something for the city in terms of a doc or a content project that could kind of highlight some of the beautiful things that we enjoy about Detroit when we return that other people hadn't necessarily been paying attention to. And during that time, I also was in Detroit for like a extended period. So it was during the winter, so I got a chance to kind of see Detroit in a very different light than other, expats who come home, because I was now just basically in the city looking for things to do on a daily basis. And a friend of mine who I grew up with by the name of Alan Esther was a DJ, and I started following him around and going to different clubs he was spinning at, and I kind of felt like I was seeing kind of a real underground side of Detroit that people talk about, but they never really get to witness. And in exploring this underground, I really learned that a lot of these guys travel throughout the world And when they travel throughout the world, they're met by fans and people who really have not only an interest in them and their music, but they have a real interest in Detroit.
That so, Detroit brand name, right?
Yes, that Detroit brand name, that Detroit like music that's kind of beyond Motown and beyond what we know from Iggy Pop, M5, Bob Seger, and kind of rest with these guys, Kevin Saunderson, Juan Atkins, Derek May, Eddie Folks, Carl Craig. There's a lot of these guys that I would say if throughout the year, they probably do close to 200 and 250 dates throughout the year traveling, representing Detroit as some of our ambassadors in a way that people inside of Detroit kind of aren't knowledgeable of. And people in the States also aren't knowledgeable.
So you're kind of drawing the curtain for the rest of, for the rest of the world that is not as tightly plugged into the electronic music scene and say, look what it's saying about Detroit to the rest of the world.
Without question. And it all started by a gentleman, Juan Atkins. He was doing a show in Amsterdam, and my partner, Jennifer, was like, we need to start making the next step and seeing what are these artists' lives outside of Detroit when they go do these shows. So in that trip alone, we were just able to see kind of, an excitement around Juan that we hadn't seen when we follow him at Movement or when we're with him as he goes through his daily activities in Detroit.
Christian, you know what they say, a prophet unheeded in his own land, right?
Yes, yes. It's definitely that case. And in some of our trips to Detroit and being at Movement Festival, which happens over the Memorial Day weekend, an organization called Paxil House does 3 days down at Hart Plaza, which attracts over 100,000 people to the city over that weekend. And these people come from all parts of the globe. We've met people who tell us that, you know, Muslims go to Mecca, but techno lovers go to Detroit. And just that kind of thought alone made us say, hey, man, we have to really kind of start connecting with these techno lovers and look at this as a possible tourism bridge as well. So that then took us to Tokyo with Derek May, and I could go on and on. But, you know, we've also been to Russia, Nizhny Novgorod, Russia, which is the Detroit of Russia. We met some young people online who had such an interest in Detroit techno that they had an actual Detroit techno festival in Russia that they invited us out to film and be a part of. So, you know, going to South Africa was really just one of the steps in kind of searching out how far the impact of the Detroit brand, in particular Detroit electronic music, has traveled around the globe.
Christian, when you talk to these fans in Russia and in South Africa and as you go around the world, what's their impression? What's their image of Detroit?
Yeah, their image of Detroit is an artistic utopia. Like, in spite of the realities of Detroit's underbelly, you meet people in Russia or in South Africa who are excited that someone from Detroit is there. They see it as a badge of authenticity, that we are there, kind of checking out their scene. They look at what they see in terms of the Heidelberg Project, or they look at how the deteriorated buildings, how people are taking pictures, and they look at the graffiti and the street artists, and they look at that in some way as, the badge, the golden badges of artistic courage that are happening in Detroit in spite of the backdrop of it being bankrupt and crime and things that the flip side is the artist and kind of the movement that comes from those artists are really what they're inspired by and gravitate towards.
I'm speaking with filmmaker Christian Hill, whose documentary film is called Electric Roots, the Detroit Sound Project. And here you go. You get accepted at the Cannes Film Festival. And that must have given you a big boost in fundraising, didn't it? Because fundraising is really the do-or-die part of being a filmmaker.
You know, it definitely gave us a boost more in exposure. In terms of fundraising, we have yet to really tap into a reservoir of capital as of yet. Even to get to that point, we've had to kind of pool personal finances as well as work with television networks that aren't our ABC, NBC, CBS type, and work with them in terms of sharing content that we've shot with their network. I did a piece called Postcards Mandela that aired on the Africa Channel, which was really another 25-minute piece that was the flip side to our trip to South Africa, where I basically illuminated kind of modern-day South Africans' look on their country, you know, post Mandela's release and post the fall of apartheid. So that 25-minute piece was nominated for an NAACP award this past year. So I've had to kind of go into sometimes business deals with networks and say, hey, I'll do this for you. In turn, you'll do this for me, or you'll pay me to do this, and that then will allow me to kind of do the things that I want to do creatively. In terms of fundraising, really the micro grant that we received from the Awesome Foundation, Awesome Detroit, this past month is one of our first, I want to say, big donations. A lot of the donations up until this point have been through friends, family, and people who believe in the project. We've also been selling T-shirts, taking a page from Spike Lee, you know, just trying to immediately merchandise kind of who we are and what we're doing and giving people the opportunity to be a part of it by buying a T-shirt or a sweatshirt. And that's helped to a certain degree. But
it's an uphill battle, isn't it?
Yeah, it's an amazing uphill battle. And every day there's a new call for more. We need more money. So.
And then you made headlines, probably you really didn't want to. You were when some of your footage and equipment was stolen from your car when you were working in Detroit. Have you gotten any of that back?
You know, I'm still trying to remain positive. No, we haven't got any of it back yet. We put out a $1,000 reward for our Zoom a recorder, which really held all the audio from the 3.5 weeks I was there shooting in Detroit. I was there to shoot a festival called the Charivari Festival, which is one of the newer, events happening in Detroit that I really wanted to be a part of on the ground floor. So I was there 2 weeks out prior to the event and a week after in order to basically talk to as many as 20 to 30 DJs, tastemakers, and kind of festival organizers to get the whole story. And in that, I shot over 1,000 gigs of footage. Of that 1,000 gigs of footage, I did not back up any of the separate discrete audio.
Ooh.
So that basically has caused me a lot of heartache and headache to not only lose the audio, but I lost two camera bodies, two lenses, and a couple other, you know, some interviews that I had on a card. But on the flip side, in order to stay positive about it, like, I do have 1,000 gigs of footage that I have been going pouring through since I've returned just to find out how much I've now lost in terms of these interviews and the reality that I shot while I was there. That has been heartbreaking, but nonetheless, the city has rallied around me, my friends, organizations, as well as Devin Skillian at NBC Detroit, who really rallied around me, invited me down to Flashpoint, so I was able to speak with him on Flashpoint. So you're right. It's unfortunate, but this happening has allowed me to talk to a bigger audience and has allowed for people who were on the sidelines at one point in time to jump in and say, hey, I support you, and we want to help you in any way we can.
And for those who want to find out more, and I know your hope is to turn this into a full-length documentary.
Yes.
So those who want to support you or follow your progress, what's the website, Christian?
The website is DetroitSoundProject.com. And you can go there, and if you like, please donate. You can find more information about what we're doing. It'll also lead you to not only the trailer for our short film, but several other micro films that we've been kind of curating and making all along this process. Really, you can go to our website or our Vimeo page and see kind of how our story and our project has evolved through the videos on the site.
Filmmaker Christian Hill. His short documentary film is called Electric Roots, the Detroit Sound Project. There'll be a screening on September 27th of his film at the Charles Wright Museum in Detroit. You can get lots of information on the screening and on the progress of Christian's film at the website, DetroitSoundProject.com. Christian, thanks so much for speaking with us.
Hey, thank you. And again, I hope everyone has an amazing day.
This is Stateside. I'm Cynthia Canty. Tax increment financing, or TIFs. A TIF allows a city's downtown development authority to capture a portion of the city's taxes, set it aside to use for economic development, to clear up blighted neighborhoods, attract new business. There's plenty of good that can be done with a TIF, but it all happens without taxpayers knowing what's being done with their tax dollars. And that's raising concerns across the nation, including here in Michigan. David Bieri is an associate assistant professor of urban and regional planning at the University of Michigan. David, give us an example of how a TIF works, TIF 101, if you will.
Well, Cynthia, thanks for having me on the program. TIFs, as you said in your introduction, they're a specific type of financing mechanism, a type of financing that's available for local government. It's a way of earmarking taxes. It's usually applied to property taxes, and it affords local governments a type of flexibility to earmark specific taxes to engage in development. Many downtown authorities do this in the state of Michigan. There are other types. There are roughly eight types of authorities in the state of Michigan that can engage in that type of financing. And so to give you specific examples, they can range from the good to the ugly in the state.
Give us an example of a good. What's a good, solid use of a TIF?
In the early 2000s, TIF financing was allowed in smart zones around the state and from places, economically depressed places from Kalamazoo to Detroit, were able to use that specific financing mechanism to do some good in terms of addressing blight. There is a lot of good examples of brownfield mitigation that's being done across the state. Mm-hmm. And so there is plenty of good, in inverted commas, that comes with it. But as you introduced, one of the key problems is the accountability mechanism.
So before we get into accountability, give us an example of the ugly.
I think at the forefront of everybody's minds is development in Bloomfield Hills, Bloomfield Park, which in a sense curiously created blight rather than mitigating it. And so in that sense, it created a situation where we now have a sort of a modern version of the type of blight that people are most familiar with from downtown Detroit.
Anyone who's driven north on Telegraph, north of Square Lake, look on the right, and it looks like this post-apocalyptic thing.
Indeed.
That just sits there.
That sits there, and I know that people, there are a huge amount of efforts in the state and else beyond the state, too, to address this. And I know from reliable sources that there is a lot of activity in the works to address this situation that will interestingly involve more TIF financing.
So, as you say, it ranges from the ugly, like that Bloomfield development, to the good. But what seems to underscore all of them is the lack of transparency.
Yes, the lack of transparency. And associated with that, you know, you might say, why is that so important? I think it's important for two reasons. The first reason is that in a democracy, as part of the general accountability mechanisms for the luxury that we have to tax ourselves, that we the people decide on how much taxes we want to pay, and we delegate that responsibility to raising the taxes then to various levels of government, from the federal government to state and local government. In return, we have what we term as sort of an accountability mechanism, whereby how the money is spent usually happens through elected officials. And we have the power at the ballot box to express our dissatisfaction with how the public officials spend our money. In the cases of TIFs, in principle, the accountability mechanism is there, but it's somewhat watered down. And it happens in two steps, whereby elected officials appoint people to take care of these special districts.
So they're not elected.
They're not elected. They're appointed. That in and of itself is not a problem because mm-hmm. we have other unelected officials in government who
certainly
do a very good job. I give you an example at the Fed. Nobody elects. The people don't elect the chairman or the chairperson of the Fed. It's Congress or the president who appoints them. But there is a very, very strict accountability mechanism whereby the people at the Fed have to come to in front of Congress, the Humphrey Hawkins testimonies, and they give an account of what they're up to. And they can be queried by Congress. In the case of TIF districts and their appointed officials, that accountability mechanism is partly through disclosure, through regular reporting to the state. And as some of our research has indicated, that disclosure mechanism doesn't function particularly well.
How poorly does it function?
Well, we have found out that roughly up to one in five authorities report, so about 20 to 30% of authorities do regular reporting, and it's you know in a sense that is not about finger pointing, mm-hmm. but it's about disclosing a state of affairs where a regulatory mechanism isn't functioning to its best potential.
So what we're saying is only about 20% are saying, okay, taxpayers, here's how much we've spent of your tax money and here's what we've done with it.
Indeed. I mean, they disclose it occasionally in ways that are not necessarily required by the state. So another subtle point perhaps for the listeners is that disclosure isn't something voluntary. There is a specific type of a disclosure that the state mandates, and that disclosure isn't as great. So it's the same with, we say, you know, a bank that gets its deposits covered by the FDIC. It doesn't have voluntary disclosure. The FDIC mandates how the financial regulatory disclosure should take place. And it's the same with TIFs. And so while some TIF authorities volunteer some types of information to the public, they might not necessarily disclose the type of information that the state needs on a state level disclosure.
And taking it looking outward as far as damage that can be done. So there's really no way for the public to know if these DDAs are using this TIF money for the wrong things or more money than they're entitled to?
I think this is ultimately the big question in local economic development. You know, do specific types of policies work? Do TIFs work? Do they deliver as it says on the tin in many ways? And in the hardest thing for government and analysts, for that matter, who evaluate these policies, is not being able to in the case of TIFs in Michigan, because we simply don't have the data to run the analytics to say, was this a good way to appropriate money from what otherwise could have gone to the general fund? And there are many distressed communities up and down the state who might have benefited from that money being available in the general fund rather than being siphoned off for these special purpose districts.
And we know that there is some concern. We know California, they've been abolished, and Chicago has looked at them and demanded more transparency, hasn't
yes,
it?
Yes. When Rahm Emanuel came into power, one of his first courses of action was to appoint a task force to look into this issue of TIF governance in Chicago. And one of the lessons that I think Michigan could learn from this, albeit at the state level, this is not Chicago, is not Illinois.
We certainly
have to be very careful there. But at the same time, one of the recommendations for TIF governance in Chicago was to have more transparency, more disclosure, and more standardization so that people can make meaningful comparisons.
Well, we know State Representative Ellen Kohl has introduced a bill in Lansing to reform the way TIFs are done in Michigan. What would it do?
It would, I think, my first reading of it, and it was announced on Thursday. I've gone through the 89 pages of it. It's as with any government reform, the devil's ultimately in the detail. But my reading of it is it would introduce a much needed consolidation of the legislation, and with consolidation, a certain amount of streamlining of the process. I think it would enable the state to have a better way of enforcing compliance, because right now the state really can't do anything to enforce compliance.
They can't.
So it really is no punishment to communities who don't report.
And really, the DDAs, what do you believe they owe the public in terms of transparency?
They owe the public a meaningful set of numbers that we, the people, know what they're up to. And ultimately, the government officials can then say, this has worked or this has not worked. This has been a good use of public money or it hasn't. And as such, our research doesn't take any sides. We're just saying that more information and facts is always a precondition for good public policy. You can't make policy on the basis of special interest representations.
And what are you hearing? How likely do you think Representative Kowal's bill is to make its way through the House and to clear the legislature?
Oof. That my crystal ball is very cloudy on that. I think the political process has its own risks in general. I mean, we see this in Washington. We have certainly seen this in Lansing to some extent. I think the bill has many merits. It is, as such, a great bipartisan effort, I think. And I think rational people ought not to object to it, because I really think it helps address so many historically grown issues in Michigan, because TIF legislation dates back to the early 1980s, and there has never, ever been, in that sense, a type of cleaning out of the house, as it were. And I think one of the issues with new legislation is always that people might fear that this is additional legislation, et cetera, and that there is sort of a false trade-off between good and bad regulation. I think it would certainly go in the direction of improving the quality of existing legislation, which is huge in and of itself.
David Bieri, Assistant Professor of Urban and Regional Planning at the University of Michigan. Thanks so much for talking with us today.
Thank you for having me. It was a real pleasure.
A salute now to the potato.
This is the future.
You built a time machine out of a DeLorean?
It's alive!
It's the sound of science!
This is National Potato Month, and so many of the potatoes that make their way onto our dinner plates come from Michigan. David Douches heads up MSU's Potato Breeding and Genetics Program, and yes, there is such a thing. And David, I guess it's a real testimonial to your more than 32 years of researching potatoes that everyone in Spartan Land knows you as Mr. Potato Prof.
Yeah, if you saw me driving around campus, and my license plate says Spuds, so I kind of wear it on my sleeve.
It's terrific. You have such a wide array of research going, and to consider the fact that Michigan is one of the nation's top potato producers, there have to be a lot of farmers and manufacturers that are following your work.
Right. Michigan may be an important potato state, but a lot of the work we do has a national focus.
Because you're developing different strains of potatoes, aren't you, for consumers? Because I'm guessing our potato consumption habits have really changed in the last 50 years. It's not grandpa's diet or grandpa's potato anymore.
Right. Over 15 years ago, we really saw that there was kind of a change coming in the way people were eating potatoes. And we developed a new variety that we called Jacqueline Lee. And it actually didn't actually fit the market at that time because the shape and color didn't really match what the consumers were looking for. But now the variety is actually licensed to a company and they're marketing it nationally.
We have gotten more adventuresome, haven't we, in our eating habits?
Oh, yeah. I think it's really been changing. I think our young people are driving some of that.
How so?
Well, I think it's the lifestyle of our young people. And so the big sit-down dinner with baked potatoes is not what people are looking for today, but more of something that they can cook up quickly but still give them some good taste.
Now, you work with students from all over the world working to develop potatoes that are kind of tailor-made for specific countries. Talk about that work.
I have international students getting their master's and PhDs coming from Kyrgyzstan, Iraq, Saudi Arabia, Bangladesh, and then I also have postdocs that are from Colombia and Argentina. So you can see that these students are coming here to study, and they're actually working on potato in their countries and coming here and having the opportunity to learn more.
And so by kind of working with breeding, you can actually kind of develop one that thrives in a given country.
For example, in Kyrgyzstan, which is over in Central Asia, they have problems with nematodes and Colorado potato beetle and late blight, which caused the Irish potato famine. So my student here is working on the late blight resistance, and our Iraqi and Saudi Arabians are interested in more of the drought tolerance. One of my students has a research focus in that area.
And it seems really that this is important work in fighting hunger.
Potato is one of those crops that, you know, we need to get our calories on the plate, and so it becomes a good base for a diet.
As you breed new types of potatoes, it strikes me that the science and technology available today has to make your job easier.
Oh, my goodness. I just think back 20 years ago and what we were hoping to do with the technologies that we saw on the horizon, and now I feel we're living those opportunities. I kind of feel that we're really in the middle of what I consider a golden age of taking the biotechnology that's been developing and applying it to our genetic improvement of potatoes.
Like, we know that the Human Genome Project was able to map out the human genome, and have you been able to do the same for the potato?
Not myself, but my colleague Robin Buell here at Michigan State led a worldwide team in sequencing the potato genome. So the human genome was sequenced in the early 2000s. The potato genome was sequenced in 2011, and that work to me is a mark on the calendar of how we can now approach some of our understanding of the potato and the genetics work that we do that will ultimately make it easier for us to breed better potatoes.
Professor Dodgers, I have to ask, what drew you to the potato to make this your life's work?
Well, I really was interested in vegetable breeding. And when I went to college, that's where I was putting my focus. But the opportunity came when I applied to graduate school, and a professor that worked on potato breeding and genetics offered me an assistantship. And I got fascinated with it, and I've really been lucky that I've been able to maintain that throughout my career.
More than three decades later, here you are. And I did see a photograph that shows that your office reflects your love of the spud. Tell us some of the potato heads that grace your office. I saw you holding a picture of a Sparty spud.
Oh, I have a Star Wars Darth Tater, and I have the Michigan State Mr. Potato Head, and somebody recently gave me a SpongeBob Mr. Potato Head, and I have a Santa Mr. Potato Head, so the collection has been expanding over the years. I tend to get them as gifts.
What's your personal favorite way to eat a potato?
Ooh, that's a good question. If you were to come to campus here and we were making our own potato chips from our research program, you would say those are the best potato chips you ever had. And we had the opportunity in February when President Obama came to Michigan State to sign the Farm Bill, and we shared some of the potato chips with him that we make in our research program. So the president had a chance to eat our potato chips. But I would say that I like roasting them on the grill.
That sounds wonderful. David Dauchis is the head of the Potato Breeding and Genetics Program at Michigan State University as we mark September as National Potato Month. Good talking with you. Thank you so much.
All right. Thank you.
Stateside's executive producer is Zoe Clark. Our director today was Allie Billings, and our engineer was Peg Watson. Support for arts and culture coverage on Stateside comes in part from the Michigan Council for Arts and Cultural Affairs and the National Endowment for the Arts. This program is a production of Michigan Radio, a broadcasting service of the University of Michigan. I'm Cynthia Canty. Thank you so much for listening.